Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the TakeCast. My name is Davis Matic. You guys can find me on Twitter at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I am joined by professional DFS player Ryan Dowt to talk about his past playing professional poker. We talk about the Daniel Negreanu-Doug Polk heads-up matchup. Obviously, we had to talk a little bit about the 2020 elections and, is polling broken? Is polling not broken? And, you know, just kind of a wide range of crypto, politics, poker, DFS, all of the important gambling topics of the day. I always love talking to people who are as intelligent as Ryan, and I think Ryan is very, very smart, and I think that you guys will come away from our conversation with that same opinion as well. If you want to support the show, you can get bonus episodes on patreon.com/takecast, or you can just leave a rating or review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. That is very useful and helpful, and now let's go ahead and get into the show. All right, everyone, welcoming in Ryan Dowt to the show. You may not know who he is exactly, though I am positive you have played in daily fantasy contests with him. Some of my favorite episodes of this show have been in chatting with professional DFS and poker players and just kind of learning more about that world, because I think it is absolutely fascinating, and Ryan was kind enough to share some of his time with us. Ryan, how are you doing today, buddy?
I'm good. Just another day in America.
Just a beautiful doom scrolling day here in America. Yep. If you are looking to get triggered, it is not hard to do. I mean, I can just sit there on Twitter and just convince myself that, you know, the nation as we know it is ending at any minute.
Oh, absolutely. Every day.
Yeah. It's terrible. But we're going to talk a little bit more about the election and polling and some of those things a little bit later. But, you know, every time we have a new person on the show, I just like to get a sense of how they found gambling. You know, everyone generally has pretty good, this is how I found gambling, this is why I ran with gambling stories. So I'm very curious what the Ryan Dowt story is.
So my high school, I played sports and computer games and got really into StarCraft.
Okay.
Wouldn't say competitively, but semi-competitively, like on the U.S. competitive arena, but not good enough for the world stage. And a good buddy of mine, Rec Rule, never heard of him, was a boss poker player back in the mid-2000s, probably still plays, but he was the best player from the United States at StarCraft. Moved to Korea to play in the world championship and join a pro team and try to go professional out there. Found out he wasn't good enough. He transitioned to poker, and probably about 6 months later, I'm still playing StarCraft. He's like, why are you wasting your time with this game that I'm not good enough to play? If I'm not good enough, you're definitely not good enough. So like, you should switch over to poker. So I had a couple buddies who were doing that as well as him, and started playing poker probably about in between junior and sophomore years of college. Started playing, you know, $50 online. Never had to redeposit, just kind of slowly grinded up. And then
nice flex. Never had to redeposit. That's always a good flex.
It was very, very slow. It was like, you know, I put on $50 and 6 months later it was 500. And then six months after that, it was 3000. And, the following summer I'm living with a couple guys. I don't know if you know Lockie Lockerson from Twitter, but he's a,
I do a show with him. I go on their show once every 2 weeks.
Okay. Yeah. He was one of my college roommates. And over the summer, between junior and senior year, and one of our other roommates was on my PokerStars account, won a satellite to the main event. At the time, I'm just like a limit hold'em player, playing like, I don't know, 1-2 limit or 2-4 limit online. I'm like, well, I guess now I have to learn how to play no limit. So I jumped over to no limit, learned how to play the main event, bust day one, and then just kept playing no limit because it seemed like, you know, there was more room for growth, more games, you know, higher edge. I grinded it up, played poker professionally from 2006 to 2014.
So even after Black Friday, were you in the States still after Black Friday?
Yes and no. So Black Friday goes down. I was actually a full tilt pro, which complicated things because
I would say so, probably.
I had a large amount on Full Tilt and PokerStars. PokerStars gave the money back immediately. Full Tilt, Absolute Poker, and Ultimate Bet did not.
Shocking.
Right. I decided to move to Canada, bounce back and forth because I live in Orange County, California. It was really easy to get flights directly to Vancouver. So I got a place in Vancouver, started playing there, was able to unlock my Full Tilt account almost immediately, but was not able to unlock the funds that were stuck there and now in the DOJ. And when they decided to return it, you know, 5 years later, they took a 60% haircut out of my portion for being a Full Tilt pro and receiving payments throughout the years. And then Ultimate Bet and Absolute Poker had me on a list of professionals, even though I wasn't, you know, a sponsored pro for Ultimate Bet. They didn't return the money I had on there. It was, luckily it was, you know, four figures. It was small, but yeah, no, they took big haircuts. But yeah, I bounced back and forth between California and Canada to play poker, you know, 2 weeks every month. And it quickly became obvious that, you know, that was a little unstable to be paying for two apartments, paying for, you know, two flights a month. And
yeah,
you know, I needed to find another solution. And the immediate solution was Bovada, just, you know, play games from the States more often than leaving the country and go up to Canada for, you know, WCOOP, Scoop and the bigger series.
Yeah, the big online like series. Right.
Yeah. And then I eventually found DFS and was able to transition away from poker almost entirely.
So when you were playing, were you mostly, you know, MTTs, ring games? Like, were you like, you know, grinding the high stakes, no limit hold'em, cash games, PLO? Like, what was your primary game, or just all of it at first?
It was a little bit of everything. Yeah. So, I mean, when I first started, I was limit hold'em. Then I transitioned to no limit hold'em, grinded up through the limits to, I would say, upper mid stakes, not quite high stakes. Then won a big live tournament. And at the time wasn't much of a tournament player, but realized that I had some things going for me in my game that were good for tournaments. So I started playing more tournaments and cash, and used, you know, the big win to jump up in stakes and played high stakes cash for probably the next 2 years. But probably around 2009, I realized that, you know, I could play, you know, four tables of 25, 50, no limit, or I could play 10 tables of 3-6 no limit with double the win rate. And I'm like, why would I play higher stakes when I can basically win almost the same amount of 3-6 without any swings? So I just became like a mid-stakes grinder in no limit and PLO, and kind of stuck there. Played, you know, Sunday tournaments, but I didn't play the weekly tournaments, you know, daily, like Tuesday, Thursday stuff.
Right.
Except outside of, you know, the big series. Still traveled a little bit around for live tournaments, but preferred online cash, and then played a bunch of online tournaments. And by the end, I was probably a better tournament player than I was a cash game player, but I, you know, my first love was cash games. I don't really enjoy the huge swings, you know, the massive variance.
Yeah, 100K down swings on like every two weeks, right?
On like a 200 average buy-in, like you can have an 100K down swing. It could get really brutal really fast. Whereas, you know, if you're playing 2-4 no limit, you're never going to have like, you know, more than a 20K down swing. And that's huge. That's like a huge down swing for a 6 or 9 max player. Heads up's completely different. All things are off limits. But yeah, I mean, I didn't. So I basically, you know, I would play cash during the week, then I'd play the Sunday tournaments, and, you know, once a year have like a big weekend where, you know, I make money for the year in tournaments,
but
you're like slowly bleeding until you have like kind of a bigger score, especially with the Sunday ones where it's bigger fields and, you know, it's even more top heavy than, you know, like a 200 man weekly 1K where you're going to final table like, you know, once every twice a year or something.
And yeah, it's like it's even more like the way that poker MTTs work, for those of you who don't, you know, have not played a ton of cards or anything, or don't remember. I barely remember what it was like, because I was playing on my dad's account on Full Tilt, because Black Friday happened when I was a freshman in college. So like most of my online experience, I was playing on my dad's account. So it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
But like you could, like in NFL, it would be very, like, you'd have to be really bad to go 0-16 if you were playing like the equivalent size and structure in NFL DFS. Like if you played 10 entries in the Millie Maker, you know, every week for 16 weeks, it would be very hard to like negative what, like 40% ROI is probably your expectation. Whereas like it really would not be, it really would not be very hard to go literally minus 100% ROI over 4 months of those Sunday tournaments in poker.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you're playing like 20 tournaments every Sunday, you're probably more like minus 80% a lot of days, but yeah, I mean, it could get really brutal really fast. And I mean, there are ways to compare it though. Like for instance, in poker, you know, it's much easier to justify bad results. You know, you have your poker tracker up, you see how many big blinds per 100 you should be running at. You see how many, you know, buy-ins under EV you are, you see, you know, oh, I got set up here and here. I haven't had, you know, good situations deep in tournaments. It's very easy to chalk things up to bad luck. Whereas in DFS, you know, you can, everybody has the same cards, you know, everybody has the same opportunity to make the same teams. So, you know, you see somebody else doing something on a particular Sunday, it's very easy to be like, oh, what did I miss? Or, you know, instead of, unlike, you know, the exception would be something like last weekend where, you know, people had two or three injuries in their lineups. But if something like that does not happen, it's very easy to second guess everything you did all week. And a lot harder at times to deal with the swings when you don't know if you're making mistakes or you don't know if you're just getting unlucky.
Right. So when you were still involved in playing at a high level, like when, because I don't actually even know this, like kind of when did solvers come into the equation, which is, again, if you don't, you're not a big poker nerd. It's basically the idea of a computer being able to tell you what the correct decisions are in no limit hold'em. I think limit hold'em has, you know, very, very clear decision trees, and like oftentimes there's very clearly a correct decision across, you know, all of the nodes, and that those have been known for a while. But no limit hold'em is still, I think, you know, not even close to a solved game basically. And, you know, I like, were there, you know, people you knew, like guys who had, you know, primitive versions of the solvers back when you were still playing?
Yes and no. Like, so when towards the tail end of my career, they started popping up and I wasn't using them as much as I should, but earlier on I had found different kinds of solvers for tournament situations that were extremely helpful because, so, I mean, I'm talking way back. This is like dinosaur poker. Like 2005-ish, 2007-ish, you know, the cash game players and the tournament players played very differently. The cash game players preferred, you know, deep stack poker and had a certain style about them. And the tournament players were very spewy post-flop, but were...
Yeah, you just seven bet. Get as many bets in as you can. Click it back.
But they were much more aggressive pre-flop and had the shove ranges down. And I kind of figured out that if I could bridge the gap where, you know, I have, you know, all this, these skills from being a cash game player for years and figure out the preflop stuff, I could be really successful at tournaments. And the early solvers were mostly like preflop kind of situations where you could figure out Nash equilibriums for shoving, from each position for different stack sizes with different antes. And, once I figured that stuff out, I got a huge leap up on the other cash game players who were, you know, kind of clueless at the short stacks. And obviously had a huge edge over the tournament players in the deep stack situation, but I still had leaks that, you know, prevented me from being the best tournament player in the world. But then, you know, over time, you know, the preflop solvers get a little better where they start incorporating more than just shove fold math. They start incorporating raise, three bet all in fold type stuff. And they start incorporating not just ICM, but future, I don't remember exactly what it's called, but future game simulation EV, where, you know, if I fold here, what's my equity going to be in future hands? And how does that affect what hands I want to play here? Because, you know, I could last longer. So they're much more difficult decision trees to run. They take, you know, a much, much longer amount of time than just the simple, you know, ICM, Nash equilibrium, kind of one-off shove chart. You know, those solvers were really helpful for tournaments, but for cash games, there were some primitive ones like Card Runners EV. Card Runners was a site, a training site I worked at, with, Andrew Wiggins, Makasupa.
Oh yeah.
He was the founder alongside, Taylor KV, who they had a DFS site back in the day, Draft Day. But
I loved draft day. That was the first site that I ever deposited on, actually.
Right. It was big back in the day, and then I don't know. I mean, DFS is hard for the sites and for the players. It's difficult. But the solvers back then were pretty primitive, but you could figure out certain things that were pretty cool. But then they started figuring out how to make post-flop solvers that were much more interesting. And there's still approximations, because you have to enter all of the info. Like, you have to enter, okay, this is my range from pre-flop actions. And here, you don't have to enter, you know, a specific flop. You can enter a range of flops, but you still have to kind of enter a lot of info, like bet sizing and position doesn't matter, but ranges. So ranges and bet sizing, and that limits things a lot, because we don't know if this is the best specific bet size for this situation, or if there's a different bet size. So like, you can keep running things over and over and see what kind of EVs different strategies have, and that helps. But you know, back in the day, I wasn't really aware of this stuff. I just had, you know, basic game theory understanding from Logic to try to apply to my play, and it helped. But seeing the solvers in action, it was a big wake up call into you know, the kind of leaks that people had, even up till like 2015, major leaks.
So I think that an experience that a lot of people had over quarantine was like, they, you know, they remembered Phil Ivey, they remembered Tom Dwan, they remembered Moneymaker and everything on TV. They probably stopped paying attention in a large way after Black Friday. You know, no one was watching high stakes poker anymore. No one was watching Poker After Dark anymore. And, you know, I mean, every online poker site, every medium saw a huge boom in interest in poker during, you know, this very heavy lockdown period in the United States, which it seems like we're probably heading in that direction again. But like, my mind was just blown thinking about the concept of solvers, like being like, not only will this, like, so just the idea of frequencies, which is really kind of the point of solvers, which is like, you should check this percentage of the time, you should call this percentage of the time, and you should raise this percentage of the time. Like, just the very concept of it, and then watching a solver like work through a hand was just like one of the best experiences that like, it was just a very mind-blowing experience for me.
Oh, of course. I mean, I remember when I was trying to almost like mentally think about these game theory spots back in the day, before I had access to a solver. This is like late in my poker career, and I'm like, I just don't understand how I'm supposed to like check and defend enough hands when I'm supposed to bet these hands, and I can bet these hands, and then I have to bluff these hands. And then you just watch the solver just like spit out an answer that you're like, I have to defend so much more than I thought I had to, or so many hands that would feel uncomfortable back in 2012 to defend, where I'd want to, you know, overfold in all these spots. And I'm like, wow, how much money have I just pissed away over all the years? And then you start noticing other things about bet sizing. You're like, wow, all those fish that were kind of like check call, like
all the check. That was the thing, is everyone who was doing the check calling was like, oh, they were printing theoretical dollars.
But not just that, but like check calling, and then they lead like 1/4 pot. You're like, oh, back in the day, like that's immediately a fish. And now you watch lines, and the solver spits out that line. You're like, wow, they were doing it right. And that's why they were like staying afloat despite having all these other leaks. They like figured out certain things that were actually, you know, much closer to correct. And we were almost in a way just exploiting their mistakes so heavily that we were afraid to battle with them and let them take all these pots and let them run us over just so they can make a massive mistake later. And it was really eye-opening to realize, you know, how poorly we all played for years. And it was, you know, humbling to know like how little we actually knew. When we thought we were, you know, some of the best players in the world, we were really terrible.
So yeah. before we get to DFS, which we are heading in that direction, this is a very good transition of you know, it being a great idea to humble ourselves. This Daniel Negreanu versus Doug Polk matchup. What do you think the true price should be for Negreanu? I gotta out myself out as one of these sick fish that bet Negreanu, and my thinking was basically like, Daniel has access to literally, I'm sure, all of the best players in the world. Like, I don't know who his team is, but I would imagine that the guys he's been studying with are total crushers, right? Who understand the solvers, who understand the game tree, who understand not only those things, but how to teach Daniel those things, and are able to, they're going to be able to give him strategies to implement even when he feels lost. And I also, like, I think that Daniel seems largely intelligent, right? Like, I think he's clearly one of the best tournament players. I don't even know if Polk would argue that. Like, I don't know if Polk would be like, oh, Negreanu is a bad tournament player. I think he would probably say he's good. But, man, four and a half to one was not a good price. I will definitely say that.
Right. So it was a really hard thing to try and handicap before the fact, because you can you know, find a poker variance simulator. You can enter the likely standard deviation for 100 hands for heads up poker, and you can guess at win rates and see kind of how often somebody with a negative win rate of you know, minus 10 big blinds per 100 wins over a sample of 25,000 hands. But, you know, until they start playing, we don't really have much of an idea. And the Bill Perkins argument was, you know, Daniel's a great poker player. He's a smart guy. He has access to really good training. He's looking at the solvers. Like, why can't he learn approximations well enough, you know, with preflop charts that basically are perfect? Why can't he learn approximations well enough that make him not that big of an underdog and chance? You know, it was a decent argument at the time, but after the first live session, I estimated that Doug was probably a 15 big blind per 100 winner, maybe even a little higher than that. And I saw all of the sharks offering things like 6 big blinds per 100 cross books, and I'm like, he's much bigger than that. It was very evident from how Daniel played that he was really almost struggling to bridge the gap between his idea of how he should play and what the solver was telling him to do, and like what he should try to do as an easy approximation of that. Like for instance, in their first online session, I didn't actually watch the second one. I just saw Horelibus describing it as some form of a beatdown. But the first online session, I noticed that Daniel really liked and gravitated towards a 3/4 pot bet size on both flops, turns, and rivers. And I don't really think that's correct, especially in 3-bet pots and especially in, on the flop. Like you often want a much smaller bet size. And just like very minor mistakes like that. And then the live session, he was checking back too much. He was
oh my God, on the turn. It's like literally, yeah. I felt like he checked like 90% of the turns. It was right. Like, you just didn't get it.
Right. There are some ways to be a really annoying player heads up. Like if you go in to a match and you have, you know, your preflop charts ready and you're like, okay, I'm going to stick to these charts. I'm going to play this way. I'm not going to overfold. I'm going to make sure to defend enough of my range. I'm going to, you know, be really annoying with small bets constantly. I'm going to barrel a lot whenever I have a gut shot. I'm going to barrel whenever I have any equity. I'm going to put a lot of pressure on. If I bet two streets, I'm going to fire the third barrel quite a bit. I'm going to always bluff the bottom of my range. If you go in with that mindset and you don't really have a great idea of the specifics of how you should carry out strategies, but you have the overview of what you should do, you could be a really annoying person to play heads up. Or like overbetting turns 1.5x pot when you're the preflop raiser, the C better, and the board texture changes on the turn, you can overbet the turn 1.5x pot like 90% of the time and make your opponent absolutely miserable, even though it's not a 100% correct strategy. And it didn't seem like Daniel was doing these things that would annoy Doug. He was taking the passive route too often. And if you're the underdog and you're taking the passive route against somebody who's, you know, one of the best heads up players of all time.
Yeah.
One of the best heads up players of all time. Right. I mean, Doug doesn't even need the solvers to jump into games and be like a winning heads up player at mid stakes right now. Like he can do it in a month. But you know, his skill combined with solvers and everything, you know, that's been updated over the last 3 or 4 years where he hasn't been grinding is just an insurmountable edge for somebody who's playing too passive. So I do think that Daniel actually played a little better online than he did live, even though Doug was, I thought Doug played a little poorly in the live session. Towards the end, he was definitely over bluffing and being a little bit ambitious in some of his moves. But I think Daniel is just giving up a little too much. It's really hard to learn enough to play a certain way, especially when that's so foreign from your natural game. Like almost like I didn't actually watch the sessions, but the Helmuth and Antonio sessions where they played heads up. It sounded like Hellmuth, you know, he doesn't play.
I was pretty impressed, to be honest.
He doesn't play how Solvers play, but he sticks true to a style that he understands. And I feel like that would do better against Doug than somebody who's trying to play GTO but is fighting it mentally and doesn't quite commit to it. It's almost like, you know, back in the day when people would play mid stakes and then they move up stakes and they'd be like, okay, now that I'm playing higher stakes, I need to play more aggressive. And then they play out of their comfort zone and they end up playing worse rather than the style that got them to that level.
Right.
They end up making much bigger mistakes being uncomfortable. There was one hand online that really sticks out in my mind where Daniel, I don't remember the action leading up to that point, but the pot was like 15,000 on the turn and it's 8885. And Doug pops.
This was a brutal hand.
Right.
Yeah. Doug I remember this one too.
Daniel calls with 9-7, a gut shot with like, no equity. It's just, you know, and then Doug blasts the river and he got unlucky to get six outed for a full house. Maybe I don't know if he calls off if he rivers a straight as well, but I mean, the turn call is just absolutely atrocious. You know, there are hands to get sticky with. You know, if you have something like ace jack, you can get really sticky. Ace 10. If you have any pair, you can get sticky, but like I don't understand why, you know, with 9-7, especially 9-7, a hand that could potentially block some of the hands that Doug might be, you know, turning into bluffs on the turn and into three street bluffs, like the bottom of his range. It's just really lighting money on fire in a way that, you know, he's trying to play a certain way, trying to play a certain style, and it's not, you know, natural for him, and it threw up his whole game. So it's going to be very tough, especially now that I would guess, I don't know the exact numbers, but it sounds like he's probably down 7 buy-ins.
He's down 260,000.
Okay, so six and a half buy-ins with, you know, 24,000 hands left. I think he should probably quit at 12,500 hands if he's down, you know, more than 15 buy-ins.
It would be a sick rally. What I'm rooting for personally is I'm actually rooting for him to be up at 1,200 or 12.5K hands and want to keep playing. That's right. Actually, I think that would just be the most incredible, because I actually think he would. Like, I think that Negreanu, maybe he would have sat there and been like, this was the hardest poker I've ever played and I feel extremely blessed to be up right now. But I have a feeling if he was up, he would want to keep playing.
I think so too. I mean, it's just so tough. It's not like, you know, so one of my skills as a poker player back in the day was, you know, I could sit down at like a 9 or a 6-handed table. I could look around at the table and I could be like, okay, I know how to play on this table. So where I'm a winner. Like, I'm not necessarily going to be the best player on the table or the biggest winner, but I know how to play a certain style to win chips or win money at this table. And I think Daniel's pretty good at that as well. He's probably one of the best of all time at that, actually. But at the same time, he's very good at playing, you know, really bad players and one of the best of all time at that. But when you're heads up, there's no hiding. There's no hiding behind other players. There's no saying, okay, I can overfold a little bit here, but take advantage of this other spot enough so that I'm still winning money. You can't hide. You have to play every spot. It's only you and the other and your opponent, and you can't fold away too many hands, because, you know, you're just not going to make the nuts that often. You're just not going to have a strong hand that often. You have to get in there and really battle. And it's just very hard to overcome that. It's very hard to develop a style that, especially nowadays when, you know, Doug isn't probably adjusting that much. He's probably just kind of playing his game and maybe some very minor adjustments. But I mean, you can't find an adjustment to somebody who's trying to play what he thinks is optimal. There's no way to adjust to GTO. And obviously Doug is not playing GTO. He's nowhere close.
Yeah, no one plays exactly.
Right. If there was a GTO bot that played Doug, he would probably lose like 20 bets for 100, maybe 25. It would be a bigger bloodbath than Doug versus Daniel is. But, you know, when somebody's trying to play that way and they're close enough that, you know, like anybody who's not, you know, one of the best in the world can't find those edges, you're not going to be able to find an adjustment that helps you. So it's just a very hard match for him. And it's nothing against Daniel. You know, he's one of the best players of all time. He's very good at multiple games. He's good at different styles. He could be a decent cash game player if he wanted to. you know, especially 9 max, but heads up is a different animal altogether, and heads up cash is a different animal altogether. Deeper stacks, he's just fighting uphill battle on all fronts, and then online too. It's a little foreign to him. You know, he's playing somebody who's played millions of hands. He's played probably 100,000, 200,000 hands lifetime online. It's a big difference.
Yeah. All right. So let's do a little transition now into daily fantasy. You know, you said you found that around 2014. I'm assuming that your story is very similar to many people, that you were able to develop projections early on, develop an optimizer early on, but maybe not, right? I know that is, you know, a lot of what powered Sahil early on was that he was able to basically, you know, have what every daily fantasy site has now, which is an optimizer with all these different functionalities to create 150 lineups, you know, much more easily than you would have to do by hand. But maybe not, you know, so kind of what is your journey through DFS been like?
So my journey started probably 2013. I, you know, was playing a lot of season long fantasy with friends in like small Yahoo league, like the $100 Yahoo leagues, the $500 Yahoo leagues, doing pretty well in those. And I was like, oh, I should play some DFS. And I was in a group chat with some poker players like Kyle Cannon. Do you know Ruthless Adam Levy?
Yeah.
I think Peter Jennings, CSU Ram, was in there, but he wasn't really very active because at the time, you know, he was actually successful at DFS and we were all ex poker players who were not that successful at DFS. So like, why is he going to waste our time with us? You know, giving us info. So it's a bunch of us, and you know, we're tinkering around with stuff. And I had written my own little optimizer in Python, and I'm like trying to insert projections into it, like really bad projections. And I'm getting teams, and you know, I'm entering stuff. I didn't know what cash games were versus GPPs. I was just kind of entering my teams into GPPs, and you know, not really having that much success. And I was like, I'm just gonna, you know, stick to poker and season long. And then about a year later, I revisited it at the start of NBA. And I just kind of committed to, because at the time Basketball Monster was basically the only,
that was it.
Right. It was, yeah. It.
There
was,
if you there thought was no Basketball Monster was like wrong on a projection on one night and you went against it and you were right, you'd print, because literally everyone was just playing the Basketball Monster optimal.
Right. Right. But this is before people were even playing the optimal, because they didn't even know how. They didn't, like, people didn't have, nobody had Fantasy Cruncher back then. People had Basketball Monster, and they would use that for their info, but they were just clicking around and making teams.
They were literally sorting by value or by ratio, actually, is what they call it on BBM.
By ratio, right. So I figured out pretty early on how to export the values and then optimize them in Cruncher. And, you know, I'm printing, like me and Make It Rain were working together on this stuff. And we're printing, but I was really held back in my development because some of the other top players, their teams were so different from mine that I'm like, what am I doing differently? Like, these guys have been playing for years. They're some of the biggest winners. Like, I'm afraid to fire because I'm not sure.
You don't want to try and own the lobby if you think your teams aren't good.
Yeah. So I'm like, maybe I'm just getting lucky. Maybe I'm just much better than the bad players, but I'm not as good as the good players yet. Well, like, let's see. So, I mean, I took basically the same approach I did to poker. I, you know, compartmentalized it compared to poker entirely. I didn't like mix bankrolls. I was just like, I'm going to deposit, you know, $500, maybe $500 each site and run it up and never deposit it again. And I was just like, I'm going to grind, you know, like 15% of my roll each night. Cause I'm getting lots of heads up back then. There was, you know, tons of the small heads ups and the small 50-50s. And it was very easy It wasn't like it is now, where there's almost no heads up, and for a cash game player, it's almost like 1.8x or zero on the money you enter. It was much more linear from zero to 1.8x. But since the edges were so massive, it was almost never zero. And you know, I started, you know, doing that all season, and things worked really well. And then baseball came along, and there weren't really any good projections. So I had to like almost relearn how to do baseball, because the first month I was a disaster. Like my not only were my teams not like the other good players, but I was losing. So it was completely different than basketball. But eventually, you know, I kind of figured that out, and that was kind of what gave me the big boost in DFS. Was, I think it was summer 2015. I was playing baseball on Yahoo, and Yahoo was a new site at that point, and it was really small. But they kept, I mean, because Yahoo was, you know, a $30 billion company, they were like,
they were just like so much overlay, and they still do that. By the way, like Yahoo on Sunday, if like they'll still overlay there on Yahoo.
Yeah. But the things that were going on were, so they were running like 10 man, 1K buy-in, 50-50s that would get like six players right. every night. So it was me, Make It Rain, and maybe one or two other friends who like were trying to learn baseball together in these 50-50s. And we're competing against this guy named Matt. We don't know who Matt is. It's just says Matt. And Matt, we didn't really start a war. It was just like us and him in the lobby. And he just decides like he wants a vendetta against us. And he starts battling us, and he was not good. And we figured out like how to beat him. And then we busted him and then owned the lobby for like the entire summer. And then that led into football season, which, you know, we started doing well again, applying basically the same process of, you know, figure out your projections, optimize, make your teams and play multiple sites. And, you know, things went well in every sport, and it didn't really get harder for another year. And
yeah. And then kind of around 2017 was when DFS got hard for me. Like, I feel like basically if you were a smart person who had access to projections and just like a general ability to parse out noise from signal, you probably did nothing but make money from 2013 mm-hmm. to 2017. My first year where I didn't get a 1099 for DFS from 2013 on was 2018. I lost a lot, I think, actually, in 2018. I don't even know the exact amount, but it was definitely a lot. Like, DFS got hard for me then. And I really had to reevaluate. And I think one of the things is you just used to be able to play cash and people would be bad, right? Like you wouldn't even have to work that hard at cash and people would just be much worse than you. And that is not true now at all. Like, I guess people are still bad for NFL, but I mean, how often do you find people who are bad at MLB or NBA? Like, I mean, I would assume almost never.
It depends. So, I mean, the first point, it's very, very hard to go through what you went through, where you're winning every year and then you have a losing year for not just because, you know, you're paying taxes on all your winnings and then 100% of the loss is on you, but you can't carry that loss forward. So,
I can't because I'm crushing this year. I'm not going to get a refund on what I paid in 2018. That's just lost forever.
Right. And I mean, not being able to carry the loss forward is brutal, but then, you know, say, you know, it's the end of 2019, it's like December, you're up, you know, probably 2 weeks worth of buy-ins for you. You can't really blast away, because if you dip into that negative, then, you know, it's just so brutal. I would say nowadays on main slate football, it's very infrequent to find major fish. They exist. But it's different than back in the day. You know, like you go through the lobby of like a big 50-50 or some of your heads ups, and you're looking at people, you're like, how do I label somebody a fish? You're like, are they a fish if they missed, you know, one of the three chalk running back plays that everybody had to lock in? Is it a fish if they gave?
Well, yeah, I think I literally think that's how I would determine now if someone's bad. It would be if they missed one of the running back locks. Or it would be if they took a huge like opportunity cost at tight end or quarterback. Like if everyone plays Deshaun Watson or Russell Wilson or Josh Allen or something like that, and this person plays Matt Ryan or Ben Roethlisberger or something like that, I would be like, I would like to play that person for more money going forward. But even those are mistakes where if you play that person 20 times, they could still flip coins with you because they're not that monumental of mistakes.
Right. You're sitting there like, okay, I definitely win 11 out of 20. Do I win 12 out of 20? Like, is it even worth me sitting this person heads up? Like, and these are some of these people are regs. Like, so you know, they're not like consistently going to set much worse. Like they'll set worse from time to time, but you don't know if it's enough to justify sitting and like increasing your variance too. And if you're just spewing to rake. It's very, you know, it's really hard to find edges on main slates where, you know, all week long people are, you know, oh, Mike Davis is 4K, play him. Like, okay, now every fish he's going to be 95%, right? It's hard to find edges on main slates, but the side slates sometimes have different pricings or different you know, roster construction where you don't necessarily have six lock plays and somebody can plug in three guys they feel good about that aren't terrible plays and you can't beat them. Now, you know, they have to make their own decisions or off sites. Fantasy draft was great because it had different pricing. Yahoo's great because the pricing is very non-intuitive. The lineup construction is very different from what you would expect if you were hand building a lineup. So, you know, there are times I'll play a fish on Yahoo where I think he's maybe 10% to win. And that happened quite a bit on Fantasy Draft, happened quite a bit on Fantasy Aces, it happened quite a bit on Yahoo, but it doesn't happen on the main sites as much. It'll happen sometimes on Showdown too. You know, the people aren't handing out lineups left and right, like, oh, this is the chalk for the Showdown slate. No, they're just playing who they like in that game.
Playing who they like, yeah.
Right. But it goes both ways. I mean, there are times I get fish in a heads up on Showdown where I'm like, okay, I might be 51% here. There are times I'm like, I maybe made a mistake and I'm 49% here. But then there are times you're like, this guy just dumped all his money and he's maybe 10%. He would need like a huge outlier game, but you know, maybe 10%. And that doesn't really happen on main slates. Main slates, it's usually, you know, you play a fish, you're like 52%. You don't even know if you're winning. Sometimes you're 57%, sometimes you're 60, but you're never really printing like you were back in the day. So it's definitely a harder landscape to be a cash game player. But and then there are other aspects to cash games that make it a little bit of a mind fuck too.
Yeah, well, owning the lobby, do you play a guy X, Y, or Z in three-mans, or do you not? Do you play a different team in five-mans and ten-mans than you do in head-to-head? Like, there is a whole other list of things, and my guess is, just from talking to you here, is you probably play the same team and everything, and you very rarely are making overrides on your projections. Like, whatever your optimal team is, that's what you're playing, and like the you know, I think that this projection might be wrong type stuff is not entering into your decision making all that often, but maybe that's a wrong read.
Well, so here's the thing, like, that would normally be true, but you know, there I would say most Sundays, you know, I open up, you know, Cruncher for I enter my projections, I run it on DraftKings, and there's 150 teams within a point. So at that point, you know, that's within margin of error. I could make a mistake for a point on a player. Like, if, you know, for instance, I had Dalvin for 24 DK last week. He very easily could have been 26 and a half DK. He could have been 28 DK. We don't know. Like, I could have made a mistake, and like, 1 point isn't enough to eliminate a lineup. And when you're dealing with that many lineups, it becomes like, it's not just about, you know, the numbers anymore. It's about what lineup do I think is the safest in cash games. When right. dealing with both ownership and guys who can potentially break the slate and win it single-handedly for people, like, do I want to block this player who could single-handedly beat me in all my head-to-heads, even though I think it's a mistake to play him, a very small mistake. I should probably lock him and then, you know, give up half a point here just to increase my overall win EV. There's a lot of considerations, and the pricing's gotten sharper. The opponents have gotten sharper. It makes everything really difficult. And another aspect of the pricing being sharper is it's much harder to make a really bad team. When everybody's priced how they should be, everything's a flip. It's not really that accurate because, you know, lines move from open and DraftKings pricing algorithm doesn't just take into effect, take everything into account and isn't perfect, but the pricing is pretty efficient, much more efficient than it was 5 years ago.
Yeah, the algorithms are better. You have, you know, 100 touts begging you to tell you about Mike Davis and Devontae Adams and, you know, who all the plays are. All right, so my favorite topic these days, because we all wake up a little bit richer every day now, Bitcoin. I'm hoping, just, you know, for your sake, that you know, like many poker players, found out about Bitcoin in like 2013, accumulated a bunch of it when it was worth pennies, and now you can just check your block folio every day and smile to yourself.
Yeah, I mean, the first time I heard about it was way back. I heard about it before it was a dollar, but so I was on this small forum. It was originally a StarCraft forum, and it became, you know, the biggest StarCraft team in the world, Team Liquid, biggest esports team in the world. Actually, my business partner owns Team Liquid, and I don't have a piece, which is absolutely insane.
Brutal, like, dude. Team Liquid, like, they're so good.
It's worth like $500 million. My poker business partner, I've been working with him since 2007. I've known him since 1999. I do not have a piece at all. And that's
so are you sitting there during lockdown looking at these CSGO slates with Team Liquid just like tilting your face off, like what's the point? I don't even want to wake up today.
So I mean, I was always a huge StarCraft fan, but I'm not as big a fan of first person shooters or the team kind of I don't exactly know how to describe it because it's not RTS and it's not.
Did you play any of the CSGO or LOL DFS during that time, or did you just take a little vacation?
No, I didn't play any of it. I just took a vacation all summer. I just chilled. But yeah, so I found out about Bitcoin on this poker forum, Liquid Poker. And the guy who was spouting it, I thought was a lunatic. So I'm like, I'm not going to pay attention to this just because this guy is a lunatic. And that was a huge mistake. And then the next time I heard about it, it was surging, and it went from, I don't remember the exact numbers, but
$11 to $70.
yeah, something like that. And I was like, damn, I missed the boat. I want to get in now because this is kind of the future of money. But I waited. And then I jumped in when it was like 500 on that run up. And then when it hit 1,000, I'm like, this is getting absurd. It should not be worth this. I mean, nobody uses it. So I sold most of it and I kept a little bit. And then it started tanking and I just kind of didn't pay attention to it from probably 2014 until 2016. No, 2016
would have been the start of where we are now, which is like where the line goes back up.
Right. So I would say early 2016, I started paying attention again and I started, you know, buying up all the coins at when it was like 600, and ETH was like $7 or $8.
Yeah. $12 F. That's a story for different time, kids.
Right. Right. And then obviously, you know, went through the whole ICO phase. And the interesting thing about that was the people who have FOMO, if you have FOMO first, you win and you crush. But I'm not an early FOMOer. I'm a later FOMO. I need some evidence. By the time I had the evidence, it was no longer the right time to buy anymore. And the bubble was ready to burst. I don't think I got completely crushed. There were some I got completely crushed.
Oh, like, I got crushed on some. Luckily, Bitcoin is worth so much money, it doesn't matter. But I'm sure I lost multiple thousands of dollars on DentaCoin and just all this dumb shit.
Oh, yeah. BitClave was my big one. I probably lost like 150 ETH worth on that. There were some really, really bad buys. And there were a couple that like made it not so bad overall, but I mean, I definitely lost on over half of them, and the half I lost that were over 75% of the value too. They were big losses, but yeah, I mean, and then I kind of wrote it out throughout the big downswing. I like knew it was ready to top when it was like near 20,000 and I sold a bunch of it, and then it dips down to like, you know, 12, 13. And I'm like, I bought it all back. So I still, you know, had to deal with, you know, an 80% downswing instead of an 87% downswing. And it was just brutal watching it. But yeah, I mean, now it seems like it's just, it knows where it wants to go and it just wants to go up, and it's hard to argue against it. I mean, its market cap is something like 3% of gold, and
yeah,
it's far more useful. And obviously it's not used as jewelry, but as a monetary system, it's far more useful. It's, you know, more divisible, more easily transferable.
And everything, like literally every day, someone else with billions of dollars, like very secretly buys Bitcoin. Like, like there are big stories, right? Like Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy and everything. But then there also are like very underreported, like billionaire X just bought 113 Bitcoins. And it's like, to me, it's very clear. I mean, obviously I'm like the biggest bull ever and I'm just like, it's never going away and it's here. But like, I don't know, if we're talking about $100,000 Bitcoin in 3 years, it's not like any of us are going to be particularly surprised, I don't think.
No. And we're talking about things that like are multiples higher that we think are like possibly over 50% to happen in a short period of time. And I don't know, I've never seen a bet as good as Bitcoin is. for the next, you know, 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and so that's a good point.
It's definitely not too early.
Well, that's okay. So it's not too early and it's not too late. Like, if you're sitting there and you're like, well, I already missed it. You know, I hear all these people who bought Bitcoin at $800 or $3,000 or $9,000. Like, even someone on the outside right now would look at the price and be like, oh, my friend bought at $9,000 and I could never make that much profit. Like, I would not say that. I would say there's so much room for it to grow still. And I think every person in the world who's listening to this should put 1% of their net worth in Bitcoin. Like, that's, that is my general statement to people. Or even if you don't think about things like that, create a Coinbase account and buy $100 worth and just sit it and let it sit there for the next 5 years and thank me in 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, it's obviously nothing is binary like this, but if you simplify the entire outcome to, you know, over the next 2 years, say it's a 60% chance of going to zero and a 40% chance of going to 50,000, and you buy one Bitcoin for 16,000, 40% of 50,000 is 20,000. And obviously there's a great spectrum of what's going to happen. And I think zero is close to 0% at this point, but you know, even if the most bearish case possible happens, like 5% of the time, your money's not going to zero. And when the most bullish cases, you're more than 2x-ing. You're well more than 2x-ing. You're probably more than 10x-ing. So it's just the kind of bet that, you know, when those things happen, it's just super plus EV overall. And it seems like the median case is, you know, probably something like 50,000 in the next 18 months, which is, it seems insane, but it's really not when you compare the market cap to the market cap of other things. There's so little interest in it right now compared to what it was like in 2017 when that kind of frothiness happens. What happens to the price? Is it 4x in a month? Like, you know,
it's, yeah, I mean, every your grandma was asking you about Bitcoin at Thanksgiving dinner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's not really happening right now. So I think there's a lot of room for growth.
Yeah, I definitely think that is true as well. All right, so the last thing here that I want to chat about, obviously, is the election, and that. So I will just say, you know, it is very tempting to be doom and gloom here and be like, you know, these dipshit Republicans are going to find a way to steal the election. I don't know. I mean, I think probably not. But what I think is more interesting is the conversation of, what is your thoughts on, is polling just dead? Like, does polling just not matter anymore? Because or is maybe polling just not relevant to Donald Trump because people are so unwilling to admit that they voted for him or want to vote for him?
I'm not sure if, obviously the polling was wrong. Specifically in, it seems like Wisconsin and Florida, it was well off. I don't know about other states, but it seems like in Texas, it was relatively close, like 52-48. I don't know if it was considered a toss-up by the polls, but that's not that bad of a result. That's within margin of error. But it seems like Florida specifically was well off. And Wisconsin was supposed to be a gigantic win, and it ended up a much smaller win than Michigan and Minnesota. So I don't know if it's specific area. And actually in 2016, it seemed like every poll, every state except for Wisconsin was within margin of error, and Wisconsin was just way off. So I don't know if it's a Wisconsin thing. I don't know if it's, you know, localized errors. I don't know if it's inability to vote due to some forms of voter suppression. I don't know if it's something else, but, you know, obviously there needs to be a bigger adjustment by people like Nate Silver who are reading, or The Economist, who are reading into polls and trying to estimate chances of victory, because it was quite obvious. I mean, like, I don't think the betting markets were necessarily, you know, especially given what we saw on election night, but we, you know, you're trained, especially as a DFS player, if you're a sports bettor, you know, you're trained to think I can beat betting lines, right? But when you're a DFS player, you're trained to think, okay, I need to listen to the betting line and use that info to make my lineups the best way I can. So, you know, I've spent the last 4 years training myself to trust betting lines, and you're just watching, you know, Trump's odds go up, and you're like,
yeah, you're sitting there.
I was just completely wrong again, right?
First of all, you're sitting there going, this is terrible. And then second of all, you're going, I know what this means when something gets steamed like this. It means someone right. knows something that I don't know. And then right. also you're saying, well, shit, this is exactly what happened 4 years ago. Yep. And that was the worst night ever. And I don't want to relive that night.
Right. Right. But then I on Tuesday night, when it actually went, it was like something like minus 500 Trump at the peak. And it dropped back to like something like minus 220. And I was sitting there and I was like, so I live in Orange County and my congresswoman is actually Katie Porter. And I remember during the 2018 midterms, in her election, after the specific election day, it looked like she was dead to rights. She was way behind, and she was facing in a very unpopular incumbent, Mimi Walters. And after the fact, like, she won such a high percentage of the mail-in votes that it wasn't even close. Like, she won something like 53-47. Like, it ended up being kind of a blowout. And I was sitting there thinking, I'm like, okay, what's the difference between what happened to Katie Porter and Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania? Because Biden basically just needs to hit that three-team parlay of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania to win the election. And it's not really a three-team parlay. They're all correlated. So, like, what's really the difference here where, like, she ended up blowing out her opponent and he looks like he's behind, but there really isn't enough votes in. And there's all these mail-in ballots that probably lean Democratic, especially with the pandemic added to right. the 2018 situation, where, you know, it's been politicized to the point where, you know, Democrats are more likely to vote by mail-in, and they're going to come in overwhelmingly for Biden. I was sitting there thinking, like, what's the difference? But I was like, I guess I'm just wrong, you know, because I've been trained so much over the last few years to trust betting lines and think they're efficient. And, you know, you wake up in the morning, you go to bed and Biden's plus 190. And then you wake up in the morning and Biden's minus 300. And you're like, well, shit, I was right. And I just, you know, didn't have enough confidence in myself or the betting lines to hammer it. And so obviously I think polls need some adjusting in the future. I don't think they're completely dead. I don't know if it was a Trump thing. I don't know if it was specific areas. I don't know if it's shy Trump voters. It could be a lot of things, but it seems like, you know, they were probably off by like 1-2% in a lot of places, and then off by like, you know, large margins.
10% in some yeah. places. Yeah.
Right. Florida. Especially Miami. Miami was the big one, I think.
Like, I think it'll be very easy for the polling crowd to be like, look, we were within the margin of error in X, Y, and Z. You know, we got the overall election right. We called it for Biden. Biden won. It wasn't particularly close in the end. But I do think that there is something wrong with polling, and I don't know if it's Trump-related. I don't know if it's the people they're reaching out to. Like, I don't know if it's like they need to do it more digitally because they're only having like old people do it. Like, they're literally calling people's like landlines. I don't know enough about the my guess would be it's methodology related. Like, I don't think polling is like some big lie that it worked for 100 years and it doesn't work now. My guess is probably that it's methodology related.
Well, so here's a weird question. Like, from say mid 2019 until let's say April, were you ever called about it and polled?
No, never. The only people who ever get who reach out to me politically are Democratic candidates asking for right. money. That's like 100%. Literally it.
The last 3 months have been like a nonstop stream of people like telling me to support X candidates, right? But I've never, you know, been called and asked to answer questions, or I've never been polled officially. So like, I don't know who they're actually polling. I don't know if they're. I mean, it could be a lot of things. Like, so
yeah, I don't even know. Not only that, but I don't even ever know anyone who is like, oh yeah, a pollster just called me or emailed me. Like, I've never.
Right.
Yeah.
But then again, in 2008 and 2012, I mean, Nate Silver really crushed. Really, really. I mean, I don't know if that's just a small sample and we can't read into it. And these last two elections are, you know, the true picture and regression to the mean, or if things have changed. But I remember in 2012, the Romney Obama election, I was pretty agnostic about who I wanted to win. I didn't really care. I was mostly apolitical at that point. And I just kind of, you know, I took his odds to win and I looked at the Bovada betting lines and I max bet every time. They had like a 3% difference between his line and the line, and I won every state. And there was one state, actually, like Florida. Obama actually won Florida, but he had Romney the favorite. So I bet on Romney. And then the line shifted so much for him towards Obama that I was like, I need to bet out and bet more on Obama. And I ended up buying out completely and winning that bet. And it was just crazy how accurate everything looked. And then you fast forward to 2016 and it's upside down. And then 2020, it's not quite upside down, but it's like across the board uniformly off by just enough that you're like, do I not trust these results? Or, I mean, there are obviously explanations you can come up with in specific areas. Like for instance, in Miami specifically, it's a very heavily Cuban population, and you know, they have,
they react to the socialism boogeyman, dumbest shit ever to call Joe Biden a socialist.
I know. Yeah. It's like they prepared for running against Bernie Sanders and then don't change their strategy, but people buy it anyway. It's unbelievable that worked.
Didn't buy it. I the Biden campaign was really good, I thought, and they adjusted everything very well. But I think my take is that no COVID-19, Donald Trump wins, and he wins pretty strong, I think.
I think so too. I think so. I mean, that he made so many mistakes with pandemic and with the response to the pandemic, not just the response to the actual pandemic, but the economic fiscal response to the pandemic and the politicization.
Yeah, $1,200 check.
right. It's unbelievable how poorly they bungled. Like, they had a slam dunk. All you have to do is treat this logically. And yeah, I mean, he threw it away, but that's the thing. That's who he is. You know, you can't have somebody change, you know, the worst aspect of themselves and not change also the aspects of him that appeal to certain people.
If he all of a sudden would have become like compassionate and caring about the American people, a bunch of the red state voters, like, you know, a bunch of people in Texas would have been like, what the shit? I don't want this. I don't want this guy caring about people. This is terrible.
Right. So, I mean, it's the whole package. Like part of his charm and part of his appeal and a lot of his ability to stay in the limelight constantly and dominate the news cycle is because he's, you know, I said it today, he's the greatest reality TV star ever. And it's not even close to hyperbole. Like he crushed on The Apprentice. When the New York Times report of his taxes came out, The Apprentice was like a gigantic moneymaker. Like, it was one of the best running shows, highest rated shows for a long time. And now, like, if you're not writing articles about Trump or talking about Trump on TV, people are changing the channel and watching a channel that is like, he dominates views like no other. And that's because of who he is. And if he changed those aspects of himself, he wouldn't dominate the views like that. And it wouldn't be as big a story and he wouldn't have as big a turnout. And yeah, it's the whole package. It's very hard to change one aspect of a person and unilaterally make them a better. It is crazy that no COVID, I think he wins too.
Yeah. I mean, I like, obviously it's not running good because a lot of people died and everything, and it's terrible, and it's only getting worse, right? We're about to head into the winter months. It's not going to impact you as much out there in California, but like, there's not going to be anywhere for me to go in Missouri for the next three months. Like, maybe if there's a 40 degree day, I'll be able to go golf, but yeah. I mean, that's it. Like, I am inside my house for the next 3 months.
It's such a difficult situation because, I mean, we have enough data to make some assumptions about what people our age should do. And I mean, it's very difficult because, you know, we're not as at risk. And if we wear a mask and we can go to restaurants, but bars, like, how do you tell bars they can't open? Like, it's just such an impossible situation for every local government. And, you know, the analogy of comparing us to the U.S. to a giant swimming pool and somebody peed in the corner and it's going to spread. It's like, you can't stop everything that other states are doing. You can't shut down intra-city or interstate travel. I'm glad I'm not in charge of anything because
being in charge sounds like a nightmare because, by the way, a very popular narrative was like, oh, well, the United States is the only country where COVID still is existing in a problem. And that is not true. Like smaller countries like New Zealand and Australia and a lot of Asian countries, you know, have been able to do really effective work on the coronavirus. They've been able to keep people at home. They've been able to do virtual learning, and they have like basically like 100% mask compliance. I don't think that that's also another very popular and racist narrative is like, oh, well, that happens in Asian countries because all these people are complicit. And I don't think that's true. I just think it's that there are very well-educated people there, and very well-educated people are just able to follow stuff like that a lot easier than Americans who, you know, we place the value of freedom over education. But in like Italy, Portugal, Spain, England, like they're going back in a lockdown right now because they tried to open back up and it's been a nightmare. So it's not just the United States where this is an issue.
Yeah. And it's really hard for certain, like for instance, I remember probably 5 months ago or 4 months ago when some of the right wingers were pointing it at North Dakota as a massive win because they didn't shut down. But it's like, guys, look at the population density. Look at the number of people who want to travel to North Dakota from, you know, New York City or other hot areas. And it just doesn't exist. Of course, they're not going to be a hot area. But then eventually it just happens. Like, you just can't really fight it. And the only way to fight it is to, you know, as outbreaks are happening, you slowly shut off valves and you protect the people who are at risk. And, you know, you be vigilant about wearing masks indoors and things like that. But yeah, I mean, there's really no way to stop it in a giant country like the US where, you know, you can't stop people from traveling here from outside the country forever. You can't stop people, you know, traveling to see their families. You can't order bars to stay closed all year and go under. I mean, every bar will fail.
Yeah, like
I don't know. Yeah, there's no solution. I mean, it's just
like I totally sympathize with the, like, that perspective of like, what do you want my small business to die? You want something I've worked on the last 20 years to die? And I mean, you know, if we had a little bit, this is such an interesting point that I heard made on the Coin Talk podcast. They don't make it anymore. It's the best, Jay Kang and Aaron Lammer. But it's actually very difficult for the United States federal government to disperse money to the American people. Like, it's actually like a whole, they sent us freaking checks, dude. Like, when's the last time you had a check, right? Like, that's what happened to people with the $1,200. Like, we don't even have a good pipeline to support people with small business who are failing. If the government wanted to do that, there's no infrastructure set in place to help these people. So it's just like, it's an infrastructure nightmare. It's an interpersonal nightmare. Like, it's bad for everybody.
I wonder what the libertarians are saying as a solution, because it's like, you know, are they just saying,
I can tell you what they're saying.
They're just saying deal with it. But like, I mean, when, you know, you almost have to go through a quarantine early on, like, what's the solution for these businesses that really can't withstand like 4 weeks of complete shutdown? Like, they're just going to go under because they're a newer business and they don't have enough capital to withstand nobody's that responsible. Like, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
And then obviously so much money went to just like pumping the stock market and businesses didn't need it. And, yeah.
Yeah. You got to give the PPP loans to, billion-dollar businesses that would have been fine regardless. All right, man. This was a great chat. Thank you so much for doing the show. You have anything you want people to check out or wise words or anything you want to end on here?
No, not really. I mean, like, I don't have any tout sites.
You don't have anything to tout.
I don't have any businesses. I don't have any books. I don't have anything to sell. Yeah, nothing. It's tough. When you're just yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Everyone, you can follow Ryan on Twitter if you want. You can get you can do that at @RCDoubt. And you can go buy some Bitcoin. Be motivated to go buy some Bitcoin after listening to this, and we will be back next week.